Larson & Larson is a proud sponsor of Joy on Paper. Our law firm has the experience and knowledge to help you protect your valuable intellectual property. From trademark, copyright, and patent applications to negotiating licensing agreements, the attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida are here to advise you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com. That's Larson & Larson, your intellectual property attorneys.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hi, this is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing. My name is Patsy Gill. Yesterday was Memorial Day, and so today I would like to dedicate this program to one of America's greatest heroes, Colonel Leo Thorsness, an F-105 pilot who received the Medal of Honor and was a POW for over 6 years. My first guest today is Chuck Beiler, the author of Tempered Steel, a story about another F-105 pilot, James Kassler. Chuck, are you there?
I'm here.
Hi. Great. Thanks for joining me today.
Yesterday
was Memorial Day, and my thoughts were with my own father, Eldrick Hendrickson, who won a silver medal in World War II, and about all the F-105 pilots who have come to mean so much to me. As you know, I am developing a mini-series called Forgotten F-105 Warriors, and your book, Tempered Steel, is one of the best books I have ever read about F-105 pilots. Can you tell us about Colonel James Kassler?
Quick summary of his career. He flew in World War II, Korea, and Vietnam, and he remains singular as the only man ever to be awarded 3 Air Force Crosses. That's a decoration for combat valor, which is second only to the Medal of Honor.
And he became an ace, and what does an ace mean?
Yes, an ace under the American system is a pilot who has destroyed 5 enemy aircraft in aerial combat, you know, not shooting them up on the ground.
Uh-huh.
Kassler did that in Korea. In fact, he had a 6th and a one that was probable beyond that, but 5 makes you an ace. There were only 40 American aces in the Korean War.
Well, and before that, how did he get into World War II? Because he was very young.
Yes. In fact, he could have avoided World War II entirely since he was born in 1926, but he intentionally graduated a semester early from high school, and he signed up. He originally should have been a pilot, a co-pilot, or navigator, but the pilot school was closed, and he would take too long to get through navigator school, so he volunteered to be a gunner, and he flew 7 combat missions over Japan as a B-29 tail gunner.
Wow. And what was his background? Where did he come from, and how did he get involved in flying? What was his...
Well, he was a typical Hoosier, born in South Bend, though he didn't live there except when he was a baby. His dad managed life insurance offices, and they moved around the country quite a bit. But his father had served in World War I. Both of his brothers also served in the military. So it was just the natural thing to do as a Hoosier. When the war comes along, you sign up. So he volunteered into World War II. He volunteered into Korea. He volunteered multiple times to get into Vietnam.
And for Vietnam, by then he was flying the F-105, the famed F-105.
Yes, exactly. He had gotten in on the ground floor of the 105 when it was in its early development, and in fact wrote some of the manuals for that aircraft when it was brand new.
And at that time when it was brand new, that's where it got its nickname, which is the Thud. And
yeah, some people said that derogatorily because they had a number of losses early on. After all, there was no two-seat trainer back then. You had to transition just by getting in the airplane and flying it. And it was a beast. It remains in the record book as the largest single-seat, single-engine aircraft and jet fighter plane in the Air Force's history. Nothing that's bigger since has not had 2 pilots or 2 engines.
Well, it was real supersonic.
Yes. In fact, could exceed Mach 2 if you really wanted to, and it was the fastest thing under 10,000 feet in Southeast Asia.
Well, I've heard from a few pilots who, when a MiG was on their tail, believe that they hit Mach 2.
Oh yeah, they went as fast as they possibly could go.
Well, it was such an incredibly dangerous time that few people remember that the air war at that time was unbelievable. There was so much protection against our airplanes. And tell us a little bit about the PAC-6 and the different areas that the pilots flew.
Well, one of the reasons they lost so many F-105 is that they were flying into North Vietnam, of course, and they were carrying 75% of the bomb load. They lost almost 400 F-105s. Now, not all those were combat damage, some were operational losses, but still there was a large loss rate, including pilots. Coincidentally, through marriage, I'm related to a backseater named Vince Scungio, whose remains had never been found. He flew in the Wild Weasels.
And the Wild Weasels were the F-105s that initially the F-105s had just one seat, and
correct.
Then they modified it to give it two seats, and the guy in the back was called an EWO.
EWO, electronic weapons officer, or sometimes just the bear. But his job was to track the SAM sites, and they would launch anti-radiation missiles and destroy the SAM sites. Very dangerous mission.
Because they always had to fly first. They went ahead of everybody else.
And you're down in the weeds a lot of the time, and you're shooting at the enemy who's also shooting back with the missiles. But the SAMs were responsible for quite a few losses, as well as 37 and 57 millimeter cannons. It was a huge array of weaponry, far more than our pilots faced in World War II.
Well, I know I've heard pilots tell me that the air was so full of flak that they really couldn't see where they were going. It was unbelievable. Tell me, when at that time, the pilots had to make how many flights to finish their mission?
Like Korea, they had to do 100. When you look at World War II, it was 25 and then later 35.
Mm-hmm.
But a 100 mission was almost unattainable in most people's minds. In fact, the joke about F-105 pilots, that before the average F-105 pilot got to 100 missions, he'd been shot down twice and recovered once. And, of course, that meant he became a POW.
And Colonel Kassler was on which flight when he was shot down?
He was on his 91st, but I would interject that he had also volunteered for another 100 missions at that time, and there were pitiably few guys who got through 200 missions.
And so can you tell us a little bit about that day? Of course, you met with him quite a few times to interview him.
Yes.
And what did he say about that day?
That day was horrendous. They were on a low-level mission, 200 feet off the deck, and his wingman was shot down. And in a valiant effort to cover his wingman, he too was shot down. He took several hits from 57 millimeter, took out his primary and his backup hydraulics, took out his engine. Well, now you don't have a flyable airplane. And he was rolling toward the ground because the control stick had locked over his right thigh. And here's where it gets really ugly. He had to eject, and when he did, it drove his right knee into the canopy rail, snapped the bone off above his knee, splintered it near the hip, rammed his thigh bone up into his gut.
Okay, that's...
That's a great way to start your...
Yeah, no, exactly. It was horrendous. But he survived the fall, and he was captured.
Yes.
And then what happened then?
Well, he was a special asset to the North Vietnamese. It was all about propaganda and getting the American pilots to make statements against the war and against their country. He refused to do that, and so he was tortured extensively, as nearly all the POWs were.
Because he was already famous for having been an ace.
Oh, yeah, he was an ace from Korea. In fact, they had three of our Korean War aces captured in North Vietnam.
So he landed up at the Hanoi Hilton?
Yes.
And he was there for how long?
More than 6.5 years.
Wow. And when you met him, did he, what was his comments about it? What did he talk about? Did he talk about those years?
Yes, he did. I was able to get a hold of the original civilian transcripts when he was debriefed. I could not get a hold of the official military. But John Hubble wrote a big book for a Reader's Digest called simply POW, Prisoner of War. And Hubble very graciously handed me those unedited transcripts. And that became a launching point for dealing with that. Plus, Cashler was very generous with his time, and I've lost track of how many times I went from Pennsylvania out to Illinois to interview him.
Well, how did you get involved in writing the book? Because you were...
I was an English teacher.
Uh-huh.
This is a highly unlikely story, and of course it has a strange twist in it. By 1984, the last F-105 mission was flown, and waxing nostalgic, I began looking for the survivors. And I found myself in an airbase museum down in Georgia, and coincidentally discovered this was where Robert L. Scott had begun his flying career. And as I was reading about him in a showcase, I heard two gentlemen behind me talking, and this realization swept over me. It's General Robert L. Scott. And sure enough, he said, "Yes, I am," when I asked the question, and then I had a conversation with him. On the heels of that was the summer of 86, John Frisbee wrote an article about James Cashler for the Valor page in Air Force Magazine, and I got to read the rest of his story, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, the three Air Force crosses.
And
so I knew at that point I wrote to him through Frisbee, and I got a personal reply back, which really surprised me. You know, as a lowly enlisted guy, you don't exactly hobnob with the officers. But I was able then to go the next summer out to his golf course and introduce myself. And he told me the story about his first supersonic dive in an F-86A, which was nearly disastrous, you know, in Korea. And I knew he had a story to tell, and I wanted to write it, but I had no credentials. So I went off and got myself a master's degree, self-published a novel about Vietnam, and went back to him, handed the book to him, and said, "Sir, I'd like to write your story." And he just looked at me with that deadpan of his, neither saying yes nor no. But because he didn't say no, I started the process.
Which took a lot of research, and I understand that you traveled a great deal to interview many people.
Yes. That first year, I retired finally from teaching in 99 because I realized I needed a lot more time than teaching was providing me to do the research and writing. I put 30,000 miles on my car that year, all over the country, to the various important people in Cashler's life, from Florida out to Arizona, out to Indiana, Illinois, Tennessee, you name it.
And, of course, one of the things that that I'm sure most of the pilots talked about were the very, very strange rules of engagement that they had to fly under.
Oh, certainly. Everybody complained about that, from Jack Broughton, who wrote Thud Ridge and Going Downtown and Rupert Red 2, and everybody you talked to complained about it because you weren't allowed to hit the enemy until he was literally shooting at you. You couldn't hit a SAM site while it was being constructed. It had to be up and running and tracking you and ready to fire before you could shoot back. Ridiculous constraints.
When you met with Colonel Cashler, of course, you met his family and his wife?
Yes. Martha was a real trooper. She was already pregnant when he signed up for Korea. That comes under the heading of what was he thinking. And they lost a pair of twins, one stillborn, the other shortly after birth, because they caught a bad flu when they were up in Maine before he was sent overseas. But she stuck with him. They were married for 65 years, so she is indeed a real trooper.
Now, tell me, when after he came back from the war, he was involved in business here?
Yes. Well, first of all, he flew again, despite the horrendous injury he had suffered. He left his one leg shorter than the other.
He flew the
F-111. By that time, the 105
was gone
out of service. But he was a vice commander and could easily have made general if he could have just stuck around for another year. But he owned this golf course, and it was going under. And he decided that since he was so close to the end of his Air Force career, they won't let you fly or command forever, that he got out and he ran the golf course for many years. In fact, just maybe 3 or 4 years ago, sold it. And, of course, he passed away last year.
Tell me, when you were doing your interviews, who were some of the other pilots that you met?
Well, I spent a long afternoon with Robbie Reisner.
Oh, he was wonderful.
Yeah, Korean War ace, terrific guy, real gentleman. And Hoytus Vandenberg Jr., son of the second chief of staff, was one of our squadron commanders at Pittsburgh, and I got to spend 2.5 days, and he was very generous with his time. He and Kassler have been lifelong friends. Kassler was his gunnery instructor after Korea, and they both flew F-105s out of Pittsburgh, but ironically, Vandenberg Jr. got switched over the F-4 Phantom for Vietnam, flown the F-105 all that time, and then he gets switched out. I crossed paths a bit with Admiral Stockdale through phone calls and letters and back and forth with the manuscript as he offered suggestions. And Bob White, the X-15 astronaut, who was actually my squadron commander at Pittsburgh. Now, you don't walk up to the squadron commander and have a conversation, but I certainly knew who he was, and I had some letter exchanges with him, too, when he was retired down in Florida. He, by the way, was the test pilot in the original fly-off between the F-105 and the F-107. And if you've never heard of a 107, that's why, because Bob White chose the F-105, and he would get an Air Force Cross for the Dumas Bridge Raid in Vietnam. So quite a distinguished career. You know, he came to Pittsburgh having all that X-15 experience, where he was the first man out of the atmosphere in a rocket plane, the first guy to fly 4, 5, and 6 times the speed of sound.
Well, I always think it's so sad that they didn't keep at least one F-105 intact, and now we have to go from museum to museum to find a little bit, you know.
Yep.
It's I still cannot understand the thinking behind not preserving at least a few of every type of airplane. It's particularly the F-105, which is such an amazing aircraft and was such a for the pilots. I know that they all found it so thrilling and exciting to fly it that they didn't leave one around, you know, for history. It's very strange.
They're around as museum pieces. None of them are flying, although the Collins Foundation is trying to get one back in the air. It requires an act of Congress, by the way, since every aircraft since the F-84 has been nuclear capable.
Mm-hmm.
The Soviets keep very tight tabs on where our F-105s are, lest we return one to service, and our B-52s, you know, which the nuclear capable versions. They can go out and check them, make sure they're still sitting on the ground where they belong.
Yeah, well, I all of our F-105s are in no shape to take off, I'm afraid.
No,
it's terrible because they it's a beautiful aircraft, and the pilots who we lost so many pilots, and of course it's so sad when you look at the long list. Now tell us a little bit. I know that of course you know Leo Thorsness, and I dedicated this program to him today because he's very, very special.
Yes. There were only two F-105 pilots that received the Medal of Honor, and actually his Medal of Honor plane served at Pittsburgh. You know, he wasn't there, but his plane was, and that unfortunately was lost after the war. Survived the war only to succumb to an accident on a gunnery range. But out of all those thousands of missions north, only two Medals of Honor, and currently I understand Leo is one of only three living Medal of Honor recipients in the Air Force.
Well, his story, just like Colonel Kassler's story, is amazing. Luckily, they did do a program on the History Channel about dogfights, and I believe both of them have their dogfight is recorded on that program.
Kassler's dogfight series, actually it's posted on the Internet. You can look it up. But it was about the day he made ace in Korea. They make no mention of his book, of his three Air Force crosses, of his service in Vietnam, or the POW experience. So he remains a man who's not widely known. purpose in doing this was to bring him out of obscurity so people would know who he is. We've sold over 7,000 books. It's still available. And my publisher promises it will remain in print, and there's also an e-book version for those of you who prefer that.
Yes, it's on Amazon. You can get it on Amazon,
absolutely.
And it's called Tempered Steel, and it's a wonderful book, and I highly recommend it to everyone. It's inspiring. It's a story of an American hero, of what we can accomplish here in America when we set our heart to doing something, just like you did, you know, making a decision, because you were a bomb loader. Is that what you were?
I was a weapons loader.
Weapons loader. Yeah. And from that, and then eventually one day deciding to write a book and going out and doing everything necessary to get it done, that shows determination, and I just love that. And I want everybody, as you know, I'm working with the F-105 pilots to preserve their stories, and I collect their stories. And so anybody who has any F-105 stories or knows any F-105 pilots, they should go to my webpage. And it's radio-joyonpaper.com, and let me know, because I am happy to talk to any family member of a F-105 pilot, or to anyone who's written a book about F-105 pilots. So, Chuck, I want to thank you so much for joining me today. I know that people will enjoy your book, and I hope they'll go to the Amazon and get it. And at the same time, they should get Leo Thorsness's book, Surviving Hell, A POW's Journey. Both of these men suffer so much, and yet, don't you agree that one of the most wonderful things is that they came out still with so much spirit, with so much vigor for America and for life and for their families?
Exactly.
It's wonderful that you've done this, that you've preserved this, and I want to thank you for your service, and to thank all veterans for their service. And so God bless you, Chuck, and thank you so much for being on my program today.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.
Okay. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
I love my plane. It is my body, I am its brain. My Thunder Chief loves me, and I love her too. But I get the creeps with only one seat and one engine too. She's faster.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Are you a writer? Do you have a great idea for a movie? Want to know how to get started? Then join the Actors, Screenwriters, and Crew Production Group. They meet every month in Clearwater to talk about how to construct a winning script, get your script read by the group, or just join in the fun. Contact Barbara Harrington, the best-selling author of Give Him Back to God, for time and location. She brings her experience as a screenwriter and casting director in such hit films as Cocoon and Absence of Malice to this lively group of film enthusiasts. So call Barbara, 727-572-6345, or email her at bharrington2@tampabay.rr.com. Get inspired, and one day you may hear those magic words, lights, camera, action. Call Barbara for details at 727-572-6345.
Hi, I'm John Rakowski with Charles Ruttenberg Realty. Don't you love living here in the Tampa Bay area? Oh, I'm sorry, you don't live here yet? Well, if you already are or thinking about it, call me at my office at 727-538-9200 extension 2 for any real estate needs, including a free market analysis of your home. Your home is worth more than you can imagine. Call me today at 727-538-9200 extension 2. I'm John Rakowski.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at larsonpatentlaw.com. Looking for a good book? Whether you want the latest bestseller or a rare book, Haslam's Bookstore at 2025 Central Avenue in downtown St. Petersburg is the place to visit. Haslam's has been in business for over 70 years and is the largest new and used bookstore in Florida. With 30,000 square feet and over 300,000 books, you'll find just the right book for you. Bestsellers, cookbooks, military, history, and so much more. Check out their website, www.haslams.com, to find out about their special events. Remember, Haslam's, one of Florida's true treasures, 2025 Central Avenue in St. Petersburg, and they're open on Sundays from noon to 5.
This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
Patsy with a Z, and I'm back after playing a repeat of an interview I did with Chuck Beiler about his book called Tempered Steel. It is really a learning experience, and I wanted to share something with you about this book. Several months ago, Chuck sent me the original manuscript that he wrote. It is an amazing manuscript. When he, it was done in first person, very personal. He captured all the interviews with Colonel Kassler, and it is a beautifully written book. I cried when I read this book because the interviews were so personal. The writing was so very, very good. And this is an example of what sometimes happens when there are like too many hands in the stew. What happened with Chuck's book is that they decided, the publisher and the advisors and the people around him at the time, advised him to change it to third person. Now, there's a difference between first person and third person. And some books are, you know, we're used to reading third person and we jump right into them. But then there are some books that are so personal and so important to the teller. And in this case, it was all the interviews with Colonel Kassler. He was an amazing man. You just can't understand how amazing he was unless you do read Tempered Steel. Now, Tempered Steel is a fine book, and it's enjoyable, primarily, I would say, to people who love history. But to read it as I did, as it was originally intended in the first person, was a moving experience. So sometimes you have to step back and sometimes you have to listen to advisors, and in this case, a publisher who tells you what to do. And in this, you know, Chuck did what he thought was right at the time to get the book published. Now, unfortunately, because he signed his rights away, he cannot change it. He cannot go back and rewrite the book or put out the original version, which is a shame because it's now more or less lost to history because he can't do it. He signed his rights away. So I want everybody, all of you out there who are working on books, particularly if you're working on books that are related to a historical person, think about what you're going to do, what you want to sign away, and I wish Chuck hadn't. I would love to actually see the original book published because it, as I said, it's so moving. So the book, Tempered Steel, is available on Amazon. The pricing on the Kindle version is $18, which is something I want to talk about in a minute, about pricing on Amazon. But there are lots of secondhand books available, and I think it's a good experience to read this as a writer, to read it and to then imagine what it would be like if it had been written in the first person. So it's called Tempered Steel, And it's a interesting book. That's all I can say. And it's an example of what you have to think about before you sign your rights away. Now, there are so many things happening. I wanted to mention it's April. So coming up and very soon is the deadline for the Writer's Digest Annual Writing Competition. And that's going to be on May 6th. The Writer's Digest is really the premier writing contest. You can't go wrong entering it. It's not that expensive. You can submit, I think it's like $35 a submission. It's not very inexpensive. And you can submit as many books as or stories as you want. They are taking all categories. There's inspirational writing, memoirs and personal essays, magazine feature articles. And I know we have a lot of great magazine writers in the area here. And so if you've got a great magazine article that you want to try to win a prize for, and it hasn't been published, it has to be something that hasn't been published, send it in. Then there are all sorts of short story categories, mystery, romance, and all of that. Also rhyming poetry. I'm good at rhyming poetry. And then there's non-rhyming poetry, and I can never do that. Also stage plays. And I have met recently in the area some really great writers who have written short plays, and I would strongly recommend that you submit it. And television and movie scripts. And I'm going to talk in a little while, I think, to Barbara Harrington, who's very involved in movie scripts. And also children's and young adult fiction, which is a big category nowadays, and one that has a great market. So all of these are categories that you can enter. And there are going to be over 500 winners. Of course, the first prize is fantastic. You get $5,000, and you get to be on the cover of Writer's Digest, and you get interviewed, and you get at least four editors and agents will look over your work, and all sorts of other wonderful, wonderful things. And, of course, a paid trip to the Writer's Digest Conference, which is a wonderful opportunity to meet so many very, very important people. So think about it and go ahead to it's writersdigest.com. And all the information is there about what you have to do and about all the different prizes. And it's really, you enter as many things as you have. If you have in different categories, go ahead and enter them. You can enter them all at once and pay online, or if you want, you can send it in. But this is the 85th year that they've run this contest, and some very important people over the years have won. And even if you don't win the first prize, just to get honorable mention means a great deal when you're sending out query letters to be able to say that you had an honorable mention from the Writer's Digest. Go to writersdigest.com and look at the rules and regulations. And if you haven't written anything yet, get started, because you have until May 6th. And it's just a very nice... I think if you're going to enter a contest, that's probably the best one. And if you're not the kind who want to enter a contest yet, or you haven't completely completed your book, but you want some advice, I would suggest you go to IreneGoodman.com. And she also has, she does critiques for charity. And you can join in her auction, which will start on May 1st. And she will read your work and give you a very in-depth critique and analysis and suggestions on how to improve your work, where you might want to market your work. And that's at IreneGoodman.com. And every month she has this event on the first of the month. So it's a very nice thing, and you just make your bids online, and the winner is a winner in many ways. Not only do you give money to a wonderful and worthwhile charity to help the blind, and it's something that's very dear to Irene's heart. So you are donating to a great cause, and of course, just getting a document that is going to be of great help to you. So think about both of those things that are coming up, and you have a deadline for that. So get busy. Now, I wanted to announce that there's a meetup on April 16th. That's Saturday, April 16th at 7 p.m. at Barnes & Noble. And it's a meetup for writers. It's called Run Your Author Business Like a Boss. And it's headed by Mike Sano. Mike Sano is a local publisher. And he's trying to help authors. So it's a wonderful opportunity to just get to learn something about how to run your business as an author, and how to and just to touch bases with other authors in the area and get to talk to them. I think you'll find it interesting. He also has one a meetup in Orlando on April 23rd at 7 p.m. in O'Charley's. So do think about attending one of those events. There are quite a few nice meetups coming up, and I will be posting them on my Facebook page next week when I get back to it. I've been off my Facebook a little bit, but I'm always advising writers that they have to stay active on their Facebook, so I will get active myself and get busy on that. Sometime in the summer, I'm going to have a workshop myself. It's going to be how to write your memoir, and I will have a lot of interesting information and stories, and also guidance on what program is the best to use for just in general for writing a memoir. And I am a great advocate of Scrivener, because you are able to set up the document in such a way that you can add to it as you go along. And I want to show people how they can write a memoir. Anybody can write a memoir by simply setting up the Scrivener to a memoir format. In other words, if you're a family, you want to do a family memoir, then you just set up the chapters. You can preload everything. And then I think one of the greatest things is to do a memoir where each member of the family can actually put in their own story. And you can ask them to send stories to you by email. And then it's so simple just to plug in the stories. And in no time at all, you can have, and then you can put this together, and you can have an introduction to each story. It's a wonderful way to preserve memoirs, and you can even add photos, and it's really nice. And I'm going to really enjoy sharing all of this information with you, because I love Scrivener. It's just so easy to work with once you know the basics. The nice thing about it is it does format everything for you. So when you are ready, because most memoirs are for your family, it's not something that you're going to be selling a million copies of, but you can format it right there. The program formats everything, so you don't have to think about it. You can just push one button, and everything is formatted for you once you have you've plugged in all of your documents. So it's a great program, and I will be announcing that workshop, which will be sometime in the summer. Now, I was talking to several people who are in the process of editing their manuscripts, and I got a good piece of advice from an author, and she said one of the best things when you're in the editing process, you've printed it out, because I no matter what you do, I don't believe that you can really edit on the computer. You have to make a printout. It's not the same. It's not the same, and I think you miss a lot of things when you edit on the computer. And it's hard to see, particularly I think in Calibri, to see typos. But when you print it out, the first time you print it out in whatever font you like, make all the corrections, and then once you've done that, print it out again, but this time in a different font. Because it's an amazing, you go from maybe Times New Roman to Courier, which of course Courier is the standard for most books and most writing. But you catch your eye, it just picks up these simple mistake so much more easily, and you don't go over the same mistake over and over. So it's a wonderful little hint, and I was testing it out to see if I could if it worked, and I thought it worked beautifully. I checked a few pages, and then I went back and I checked a reprinted it out and checked it again, and sure enough, there was something that you know, I saw the word. It was crazy. I had read it on the computer three times. I had read it one time printed out, and then on the second printout, I caught an error that I didn't even recognize in the first place. So it's a good little hint. So I would suggest that you do that. And meanwhile, when you're working, one of the things that's come up lately, and this is very interesting, I had not been really involved in what it's called, serialized work. Now, there is a new format, a new company called Tapas. Now, Tapas, of course, means little plate, and one of my favorite restaurants in Washington, D.C., when I go up and see my son, was a Tapas restaurant, and I loved all these little dishes, and it's a very popular thing. And nowadays, you have a lot of people who are reading on their mobile, on their phones, and or on their iPads or their little pads. So there is now a growing market for serialized writing. Now, I have not read a lot of this yet, but it's very intriguing, and I think it's a good exercise for all of you writers out there to try to do some of this little serialized writing and see how it works. You can just test it out with your friends, even. Just do little short story. They have to be little short chapters and blended so that they, you know, move on to the next story. But you can test it out yourself. See how much you can read on your iPhone in the 5 minutes you're waiting in the doctor's office, or the 10 minutes you have after you finished your lunch, and get an idea of what you as a reader would be looking for. And then it's a nice little practice. People, of course, used to practice writing a lot of short stories, and there's still, although, you know, there aren't as many magazines where you can sell a short story anymore, it's still always a good exercise to write short stories. It's a discipline. You have to learn in a few thousand words to write a story that's complete. And now with this new idea of serialization, and it's funny, I've heard that a very famous writer, and I'm not sure yet who it is, has decided to serialize his very famous book. And he's going back and, he's got to cut it, he's got to do this, whatever. Now, I'm not sure I'm going to like that, because I don't basically like when writers goof around with their work afterward. But the idea is that he wants to open this market primarily to people who don't read now. And we want to capture more and more readers so that if they start by reading a serialization and they like it, hopefully they will move on to ebooks and even hardback books, which really nothing replaces hardback books. I know that people love the you know, digital media and the ebooks. But as was proven with Harry Potter, you had lineup of kids starting at midnight, lining up to have that book in their hand. And it was always so delightful to see my boys with their Harry Potter book at midnight. And they'd plop themselves down and read all night. You couldn't get it out of their hands. So it's a wonderful thing to try to get more readers, more people interested in reading, and when a book is really worth it, and a book is really compelling, the hardbacks follow because it's just something, there's still something in human nature that you want to touch it and feel it and have that sort of book smell about it. So there is a market for that. Now, on Kindle books and e-books, as I mentioned, Tempered Steel is selling for $18. That's a lot of money. But not so long ago, the big five publishers had made a lawsuit against Amazon, who had tried to limit e-books to $9.99. And the publishers won. And you'll see many... many ebooks, especially by the top authors, are now all priced around $12.99. They've moved up quite a bit, you know, there's a market for it, and then there's a question: is it good for the reader? $12.99 is pushing it a little bit. Of course, some authors have found that their sales have dropped off. But on the other hand, some have made more money. And so, you know, it's a hard thing to say which is best. I think as an indie author, you have to decide what you're going to price your work at. I know that most indie books are selling for around $4, $5 maximum. And you get a nice percentage, so it works out very nicely. But I would look into the pricing categories more carefully now with the uptick of pricing of the major publishers. Now next week I have quite a few interesting people coming on, and I have to just. My mind is going, but anyway, it's there somewhere. And I'm looking forward to forming a meetup group myself, because I want to talk more to writers about how they can go about building their platform. No matter what you're working on, as I've said to all the writers who you know, the writers who have come into the studio, the local writers, it's so important that they build this platform, and that, of course, everybody has to start off by securing their domain name. And so if you haven't done that, and if you're a writer, then you just have to start that right away and get that done. And then when you're working on a book, it's a wonderful idea to try to find a writer's group, a reader's group that will work with you and to be your beta readers, so that when you are ready to show it, you have somebody to give comments. And, of course, it's also very important that you get a professional editor. You can't really replace the work that a professional editor does, and unless you have a team of beta readers who are really professional in their work and they have done it before and they are all very knowledgeable about what's required from publishers and, of course, from agents when you submit a book. Unless you have that, then you have to find yourself a professional editor. And we have some fantastic ones in the Tampa Bay area. And when you look at it in the long term, it's not that expensive. They do a lot for you in the time that they take, and all of them, you'll find that editors, you know, get involved in the story, and not only do they find all the typos, but they offer suggestions. And so it's just a wonderful thing to find this sort of medium where you work with a group and then you work with an editor, and then you're ready to approach an agent, or, well, that's really what you're going to have to do, approach an agent, or if you decide to go indie. And I have a coming up in a few weeks, I'm going to have a mother and daughter team of, well, mother and two daughters
who sort of hit the ground running by publishing their indie book. And it's a fascinating story of how they thought of everything they could to promote their book. And as they say, they set a goal of how many books they wanted to sell in what period of time. And that's what you have to do. Make a decision. Don't just like let your book go out there and say, well, that's it. You have to say, I want to sell 5,000 books. 5,000 books is really a nice number to aim for. So if you can sell 5,000 books, you've really created a nice little success for yourself. But this is one of the things that I want to do with the meetup. I want to talk to writers about all of the various ways to find this market so that you can sell the 5,000 books. And it's a combination of finding the groups that will share your interest in this book, groups where you can make little speeches, groups where you can have presentations, where you might do contests, where you do free giveaways, which is a wonderful thing. Several very famous writers have given away their books to, for example, to the military. And what happens is these people then, once they have a free book, they read it. If they like it, they tell everybody in their family and they tweet about it. And the next thing you know, the name of your book is out there, not to the maybe 50 people you've given a free book to, but out to 500 or 5,000. And sometimes giving a free book is the best form of promotion as opposed to hiring a press agent who really follows the traditional pattern of, you know, just sending press releases and things like that. So that's one of the things I want to talk about in a workshop or a meetup when I set it up. So that's something to look forward to. And meanwhile, I just want to suggest that if you want to get out of the house and away from reruns and political debates, yes, don't we all, then grab some friends and head to the Miami Avenue Wine Bar in Indian Rocks Beach. It's located just down the street from the post office, a block beyond Walgreens. And on Thursday night, they have smooth jazz, which will put you in a good writing mood. And then on Friday and Saturday nights, they have live music and dancing, great wines, all natural, no preservative type of wines. And it's wonderful. It's a great atmosphere, and it's an opportunity to dance the night away. So I just want to thank everyone for joining me today. And remember, one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken on stage or screen. Meanwhile, remember, live life with love and treasure each day. Find your joy and share it. Bye for now.